Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When does a so-called glitch start to threaten policy?
Nobody's madder than me about the fact that the website isn't working as well as it should.
So when will it start to work? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 21st of October. It's good to have you with us. We're 21 days into the official start of the healthcare exchanges. That's 3 weeks. And so far, it has not been going perfectly, as even President Obama admitted today. So what's it going to take to fix the exchange sites and make this work? We called up Sarah Cliff. She covers healthcare policy for The Washington Post. Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
The president in the Rose Garden said no one was madder than he was about all the problems with the exchange websites. Is that going to mollify anybody?
You know, I think a lot of people who are trying to shop for insurance are very angry themselves right now. I know I've talked to a lot of my readers and folks across the country who are trying to shop for insurance who have tried upwards of 60 times to purchase coverage. And for them, I don't think it will help so much. I think what they're really waiting for is the moment when they can go through the application process, find out if they qualify for financial help, and ultimately get to the point where they're actually putting down a payment for an insurance plan. I think that's what's going to take to really satisfy the people trying to buy coverage right now.
To what degree does the success of the Affordable Care Act rest on the success of the exchange websites?
I think it rests on the success of the exchange websites a lot. Healthcare.gov and the state marketplaces were always seen as the main portal for enrollment. The idea was we weren't going to have people going into offices and filling out pen and paper and dealing with, you know, weeks of mailing things back and forth, that the website would really be a smooth shopping experience. It's, you know, President Obama himself said it would be something like shopping on Expedia or Kayak for a plane ticket. That clearly has not been the case. And if the insurance expansion piece of the law is going to work, the website is going to need to work as well.
We've talked about what people call the front end problems. People can't sign up. They have difficulty seeing the prices and comparison shopping. But there are also these back end problems, getting the information to the insurers themselves. Explain what the back end issues are and why they, even though people can't see them, are so important.
So what's happening on the back end is when someone signs up for health insurance through the marketplace, the website is supposed to send a notice to the insurance company saying you have a new enrollee or you have a new family that's signed up for your plan. That data, what we're hearing from insurance companies, isn't quite right. The Wall Street Journal had a funny example of someone who had shown up as enrolled with three spouses. That was an individual who had three spouses. It turns out it was actually one spouse and two children. And right now, not a lot of people are getting to the enrollment process. So insurance companies can handle these problems manually. They can call the guy with three spouses and say, do you actually have three spouses? If these front end problems let up and more people get through, all of a sudden we're not talking about dozens of applications. We're talking about hundreds, maybe thousands. Then it's really hard for insurance companies to follow up. And they're really going to need to rely on that data being accurate. And, you know, that's going to be probably the next wave of tech problems that we're going to be watching.
Would this happen if Silicon Valley were doing this and not the government?
That is a good question, and one, you know, we've been trying to understand. Yesterday, Health and Human Services put out a memo saying, you know, we're bringing in the best and the brightest to really help fix this, which raises the question, where were the best and the brightest when you were initially building healthcare.gov? Some people I talk to really lay fault at the government contracting process, which they say requires you to have a lot of knowledge about how to maneuver this very bureaucratic process and really weeds out a lot of small companies that might be able to do these kind of projects really, really well, but don't have the know-how of how to navigate this very messy, cumbersome, bureaucratic process.
Sarah Cliff covers health policy for The Washington Post. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, we had a little mix. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
¶¶
Banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase and the federal government may be close to a huge settlement, $13 billion huge, over mortgage investments the company sold in the days before the financial crisis. And that's big, even for a bank that size. But the proverbial little guys are going to get something out of this. Marketplace's Mark Garrison digs into the billions of dollars of consumer relief that's thought to be part of any deal.
Some of that money might go to Laura Bradley, who lost her job during the downturn. She says she asked J.P. Morgan to modify the loan on her family's Virginia home. But the only way to get that was to pay the $10,000 they were behind. It was the end.
I didn't have $10,000, so I said, they're going to have to foreclose on our home. It was a very, very scary time.
Later, they lost their home. We don't know whether someone like Bradley would get anything. But even though the reported $4 billion is a giant number, homeowners shouldn't expect much. Arizona State Finance Professor Andra Gent puts it in perspective.
J.P. Morgan probably has 5 million mortgages, so we're probably talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $800 per mortgage.
That's not going to do much for someone who lost their home and saw their credit score destroyed. Barry Zigas of Consumer Federation of America says current homeowners in trouble could benefit.
The details of it are likely to be much like those of prior settlements, which have included modifications that help homeowners get out of these loans or enable them to carry them on terms that they are able to meet.
Laura Bradley has a job again. She and her family, now renters, have moved on.
I think it is too little, too late. The only thing I ever wanted from our mortgage holder was the ability to stay in the home where I was raising my children. I say onward and upward, and I don't want anything from J.P. Morgan Chase.
No settlement would undo the devastation of foreclosure, but J.P. Morgan customers who suffered and got nothing may soon have something. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Starting today, New Jersey becomes the latest state to allow same-sex marriage. And also starting today, a new index, like the Dow or the S&P, but this one tracks the stocks of companies that are friendly to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. It's called the LGBT Equality Index, and it was created by Credit Suisse. Credit Suisse is also starting a portfolio for investors who want to put their money behind LGBT-friendly companies. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
When Credit Suisse came up with the idea of an LGBT equality index, it had to quantify just how gay-friendly a company was. So it partnered with a human rights campaign, a civil rights group devoted to gay issues, and used data from its corporate equality index.
So then with our index, we basically just wanted to have a metric to compare performance of companies with pro-LGBT policies to the overall market.
Nicole Dulette is a vice president in equities trading at Credit Suisse.
We start with a universe of the S&P Composite 1500, and then we filter out any company that scores below an 80.
The highest possible score is 100. There were 201 companies that made the index. Nearly every major Wall Street bank, Google, Microsoft, and Chevron were among the top scorers. Starting today, Credit Suisse clients can invest in a portfolio made up of companies within that index. Lloyd Kurtz is a chief investment officer at Nelson Capital Management. He's written about social investment, and he says that as with any type of social investing, each one has its own nuances.
For me, the headline is that most of these indexes behave exactly the way you'd expect them to behave based on the risk factors.
Kurtz says that the central measure of success is really whether the client is happy with it.
If it meets the client's needs, who cares, right? And ultimately, if the customers care about it and we give them portfolios that reflect their values and their concerns, we're adding value.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Paint yourself a mental picture of a farmer. He's probably a man and on the older side, right? The average age of an American farmer is nearly 60, but the census will likely soon show their age going down for the first time in more than 30 years. More and more young people are going into agriculture, and it's all about the money. Our Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
Ben Albright jerks an ear of corn off its stalk, pulls down the husk, and snaps it in half.
You can see there's not much of a milk line left, so it means the corn is ready to harvest.
Albright is a corn farmer in Lytton, Iowa. What makes him extraordinary is his age. He's 35. These days, more than half of farmers are over 55.
I was a child of the 80s. That was a pretty tough time in our industry.
Albright grew up on his dad's farm here in Lytton. He says back then, no one wanted to go into farming. He went off to college.
You know, I had a few other jobs, internships, things like that, to see what else was out there. But I just felt like the opportunity in farming was better than anything I could find elsewhere.
The period that we're in right now is unprecedented in terms of income and land values.
Mike Duffy is an economist at Iowa State University. The School of Agriculture there has seen record enrollment, and more of Duffy's students are going back to the family farm after they graduate. As food prices have risen, so have profits for farmers.
If all they hear is, woe is me, then they don't want to go into it. If what they see are new combines and trucks, looks like it might be a good job to get into.
Still, when Ben Albright came back to Lytton to farm, he thought he'd be one of the few.
Well, I was really surprised when I came back at the amount of young people in the community. We actually had enough people for a slow-pitch softball team, so it was good to see.
We've seen an incredible growth in beginning farmers.
Luke Gran is with Practical Farmers of Iowa, an industry association. He's standing in front of a shelf of mason jars that contain soil from farms all over the state.
This is soil from Northwest Iowa, and man, it does not smell good at all, because soil is living.
And exceptionally good for making a living. Iowa's rich soil has attracted so many young farmers, Practical Farmers started a program to address their needs.
We started with our beginning farmer program in 2008 with about 75 beginning farmers, which is now like 1,500 beginning farmers in Iowa.
Ryan Wilson is one of them. At 35, he has a 1,200-acre corn and soybean operation in Lenox, Iowa. He wasn't initially interested in farming, but when he realized he could make a good living, he took the leap.
I was building cabinets and stuff for about 11 years, and a neighbor called me, said he's getting too old and too tired to do it anymore, and that's how I got into my first 500 acres.
Wilson says without that help from his neighbor, he probably couldn't have gone into farming. That's the thing about an economic boom. Everything gets expensive. Big farms like Wilson's typically need around $5 million worth of equipment.
You have to have help, otherwise it's just nearly impossible. If you're on your own trying to get started, you're going to have to win the lottery.
Young farmer Ben Albright says his support came from his family.
Yeah, it's definitely a work truck. Flies and all.
Albright is driving the perimeter of his property, which touches his father's and his brother's.
I honestly probably wouldn't be farming if I didn't have the opportunity that, you know, the four generations before me built.
There are opportunities for the aspiring farmer without connections, says Practical Farmers Luke Gran. He says typically they just start small with a few acres of vegetables and work to build something bigger for the next generation. In Lytton, Iowa, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, a New York gallery is hosting the famous girl with the pearl earring because it's beautiful, and
my hope is that the experience will be so positive that you will enjoy the pictures in the permanent collection.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial Average fell 7 points, less than 0.1%, to close at 15,392. The Nasdaq powered up 5 points, 0.1%, to end at 3920. The S&P 500 ticked up ever so slightly, but it was basically flat, finishing at 1744. Speaking of flat, McDonald's gave back 0.6% after lackluster earnings. The fast food giant says sales will remain challenged for the fourth quarter. J.P. Morgan Chase also finished relatively flat, even after that settlement story, losing just 0.6%. Bond prices fell ahead of tomorrow's jobs data. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.60%.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. The September jobs report is scheduled to be released by the Labor Department. Finally, the Washington International Horse Show gets underway in the nation's capital, with more than 500 horses making an appearance. And actor Christopher Lloyd of Taxi and Back to the Future fame celebrates his 75th birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdal. What to do about Iran? The U.S. has been grappling with that question for decades. We've tried sanctions, threats, diplomacy, sometimes all three together. Iran now has a new president, and that means potentially new opportunities. One possibility, Iran scales back its nuclear program and the U.S. unfreezes billions of dollars and maybe eases economic sanctions. Joining us is the BBC's Istanbul correspondent, James Reynolds. He's done extensive reporting on Iran. James, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
So we're in this moment where there's a big discussion about possibly easing sanctions on Iran or other options, lots of diplomacy going on. Lay out what the Obama administration is considering.
It has essentially a lot of options from which to choose. Just to put it in context for you, over the last, 33, 34 years since the Islamic Revolution, the United States has imposed 28 different sanctions on Iran. The European Union has imposed four sets of sanctions. In other words, for the United States, the Obama administration, and for the rest of the world, there are an awful lot of sanctions from which to choose.
So the idea here is if Iran maybe eases on some of their nuclear program, that the U.S. might free up a little of their money that has been frozen this time.
Yes, it's essentially you give us something, we give you something kind of deal.
What would the process look like to start actually disassembling sanctions?
It depends what kind of sanctions we're talking about. If they're some of the lighter sanctions, my understanding is that an executive order could revoke them. If they're sanctions which were passed through Congress, such as the law about removing Iran from the international financial system, clearly Congress would be involved. So some of them are classified easy to lift, others are classified incredibly difficult to lift.
Is this a real drumbeat toward diplomacy?
It certainly is diplomacy, but whether or not it achieves anything is, of course, way too soon to tell. But I've attended, I think, 8 rounds of nuclear talks in the last 3 years, and this most recent round in Geneva was certainly the most, I think, either side would say positive in terms of the fact that there was actual real sustained dialogue. And I think one of the most important things to draw from Geneva recently was the fact that the US and Iran have quietly settled into the habit of holding open, directly acknowledged talks, which could be significant in the long run, because with all due respect to the other parties around the table, France, Germany, Britain, and so on, it is that Iran-US relationship which is critical and may be the key to solving this. Those other countries, they'll have an input, but essentially if the US and Iran work out their relationship for the first time in more than 3 decades, then everything else hangs off that.
Iranians elected a new president. What do they want, just the regular old people in the country?
They have something very clear that they want, and it's this. They want their new president to go out and engage with the rest of the world and stop causing trouble, like the previous president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So essentially, that's Mr. Rouhani's mandate. Of course, one thing that he has to remember is this. He's not the ultimate decision maker in Iran. Final decisions on matters of state security and foreign policy, military policy, are made by the supreme leader himself, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Mr. Rouhani has to take along the supreme leader with him. If he doesn't do that, he won't get a single thing done.
James Reynolds of the BBC speaking to me from Istanbul. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the program.
You've heard, of course, of Silicon Valley, and there's the Silicon Alley startup scene in New York. How about Silicon Prairie? One of the guys who started Square, the mobile payment company, wants the Midwest to be the next hot place for tech talent. He grew up there and has started an apprenticeship program for developers. From St. Louis Public Radio, Tim Lloyd has our story.
A sudden blast of heat hits my face as Jim McKelvey opens the door to a 2,000-degree glass furnace. He sticks a metal pole inside and pulls out a bright yellow ball of molten glass.
Glass is just beautiful today.
What do you think it might be?
Well, I like making bowls. So this will probably be a bowl.
McKelvey founded the mobile payment company Square 4 years ago with fellow St. Louis native Jack Dorsey. Since then, he hasn't had a whole lot of time to spend in the glass studio he built in an abandoned building. He says Square would have had a natural home here in St. Louis, but they couldn't find the programmers they needed to grow. So the company ended up being headquartered in San Francisco. To keep that from happening again, McKelvey is dusting off an old-school training model, apprenticeships. And he's giving the idea a test run with his new nonprofit, LaunchCode.
I learned to blow glass as an apprentice. LaunchCode uses sort of an apprentice model. We take people who have the basic skills, then we put them in companies and they're paired up with an expert.
LaunchCode is placing applicants at 100 companies, including local heavyweights, Monsanto and Enterprise Rent-A-Car. The apprentices, if you will, only get $15 an hour. And McKelvey says if an applicant has the chops, everyone's willing to overlook a weak resume.
The best artists that I work with are self-taught. The best programmers I work with are self-taught.
To get an idea of what LaunchCode looks like in practice, just head up these creaky steps in a rehabbed garment wholesale building in downtown St. Louis. At the top, you'll find the offices of PushUp Social. Keegan Myers is one of the project's first placements at this social media startup. Even though he's only 20 years old, Myers has been goofing around with basic web programming for years.
Without LaunchCode, I would probably be working some dead-end job, you know, so that I have a little bit of money to find some way to better myself.
LaunchCode works by pairing up two programmers looking at the same code. Brad Urani is PushUp Social's chief software architect. He says the experienced programmer gets lots of questions, and he's totally cool with that.
The more questions are better because it leads to optimizing the way things work.
When I heard about it, I was like, this is a no-brainer.
Ed Domain runs Techly.com and covers the startup scenes popping up in the Midwest. He says even if a tech upstart gets some cash, in the middle of the country, it can be slim pickings when it comes to programming talent. With that in mind, LaunchCode's model could solve a big problem for companies on the so-called Silicon Prairie.
They can stay home and they can be the next great success story for their town.
Back at Jim McKelvey's studio, a couple of glass blowers are recreating the body of a 100-year-old lamp. If LaunchCode works the way he thinks it will, McKelvey is confident he can transition the city from its industrial roots into a tech hub.
I believe that we'll actually create a talent surplus, and then you're going to see companies start moving to this region to take advantage of that surplus.
And just like Square, he says if LaunchCode's training and job placement model works here, it can work anywhere. In St. Louis, I'm Tim Lloyd for Marketplace.
She's one of the great characters in art, with liquid, enigmatic eyes staring over her shoulder. And of course, the pearl earring from which this famous girl, painted by Vermeer, gets her name. She's inspired lucrative books and movies. I wrote an essay about her in college. And now the girl with a pearl earring is coming to New York. Marketplace's Noelle King reports on how a museum gets ready for a potential blockbuster.
With any exhibition, but particularly one that includes a painting this famous, there's management, logistics, and negotiation. Colin Bailey is director of San Francisco's Fine Arts Museums. The paintings were shown there this summer.
You work years out with the lending institution to decide on protocols, guarding, transportation, accompanying couriers, accompanying security. Often the institution will want to be very clear on how you are going to hang the work, what hardware you use, what lighting you use.
For the Frick Collection in New York, one of the biggest challenges is space. It doesn't have a lot of square footage. But curators know the girl will draw huge crowds. Margaret Iacono curated the Frick's exhibition, and she made a decision.
Vermeer's girl, the pearl earring, has pride of place. She is in a gallery by herself in our Oval Room.
Adult admission at the Frick is $20. The exhibit doesn't cost extra. I asked Iacono, couldn't you make a killing?
That's true, but, you know, we also feel our permanent collection is pretty fabulous, and we want to be as accessible to the public as possible.
More visitors to the blockbuster work means the museum has a chance to build its base.
In a way, if the girl with the pearl earring, which is one of the most beguiling and enigmatic pictures in the Western canon, if that brings you to the museum and you're not a regular visitor, my hope is that the experience will be so positive that you will enjoy the pictures in the permanent collections.
In New York, the Frick exhibition opens tomorrow at 10 a.m. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the show today, which we're just going to put it out there and let you think about the value of sports punditry, a multi-million dollar business. The blog Pundit Tracker tracked 63 talking heads in the sports world to see who would pick that both the Boston Red Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals would end up in the World Series, which starts Wednesday. The result was zero. Well, okay, picking both might be hard. So how about one of those teams? Of those 63, who picked either the Sox or the Cards? Oh, yes. Again, zero. Way to go, everybody. Nicely done. P.S. Go Red Sox. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 7 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ powered up 5 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 ended basically flat. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Lina Anwar, and Bridget Bodner. Millie Jefferson directs the show. Chow Tu and Raghu Manavalan are our digital producers. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.